TCJ Radio International presents Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
We're in the Zurich office of Dr. Dennis Turner, the animal behaviorist. And I've been in this office before. It's a few years ago, Dennis,
right.
And it's very much like deja vu. You look the same, you sound the same, but maybe issues have changed a little bit. Let's go back to your past. You've been in Switzerland since 1973. You were originally from the state of Pennsylvania in the United States and lived in San Diego, California for a long time. Mm-hmm. By coincidence, a famous zoo in San Diego. Was that incidentally the reason?
I actually did work for a summer in San Diego. Zoo also, but unfortunately with the people, not with the animals.
You'd rather work with the animals anytime.
I'd rather work with the animals. My girlfriend ended up going, she was allowed to work with the animals, and she ended up going to Africa already back then at the time, but I stayed with the people.
Well, 1973, you decided to come to Switzerland, not as a lecturer at the time. You were still a student, right?
Right.
You were doing your PhD.
Right. I was doing my PhD at Johns Hopkins, and my wife is Swiss. She worked for the former Swiss Air, also airline, and she had the great idea that, well, since I'm not making any money yet, I'm still a student, why don't I come at least for 6 months and stay in Switzerland? She has a job. I can finish writing my dissertation, and my thesis advisor allowed that as long as I could come over occasionally to have good discussions with him about the thesis. I ended up staying here.
What was your thesis, incidentally?
My thesis was about vampire bats. And it was the first book that I published way back in 1975, and it was about prey selection by vampire bats. I actually worked on a Swiss farm in Costa Rica, very famous Swiss people who emigrated from Switzerland to Costa Rica years ago, the family Hagenauer, and they allowed me to do my dissertation. They had 1,200 head of cattle on their farm, their ranch, and it was an ecologically run ranch, by the way, still is today, also the new ranch that they have, but they allowed me to watch the vampires attacking their cattle.
Now, vampire bats do attack cattle, but they don't attack people. Is that right?
Oh, they do attack.
They
people.
Do.
They do, yes. It's very rare, but the one occasion in those 2 years of working nights, capturing vampire bats and marking them and then releasing them, I fell asleep. The only night I ever fell asleep in the field.
You got awakened.
Right, I got awake. I was bitten by a vampire bat, although I had prophylactic immunizations and didn't worry about it. Later, though, I ended up getting bitten by a rabid bat, a vampire, that I was taking out of my capture nets, and I thought I was still protected, and I wasn't. I ended up having asymptomatic rabies. My blood serum gave mice rabies.
That's a potentially fatal situation.
It is. It is, and it's sort of one of the few. It's a spectacular case. It's on record. There are people that have survived rabies, usually with some damage. At least I don't think I had any damage.
How do you behave during the full moon, Dennis?
Right, right. Well, I love the full moon because one of my hobbies is astronomy.
Nothing to do with turning into a wolf.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Incidentally, do you believe any of these old folk tales of transmigration of, or that's what it's called, isn't it? Transmigration.
It is. Well, we have to remember that the vampire myths and Dracula and all that comes from the old world, Europe, and there are no real vampire bats in the old world. They're all new world. The vampires, there are three species, they're all a new world species of animals. So I don't know actually how they got the confusion between the old world and the new world, but I do remember that when my first book came out, a lot of bookstores had purchased or had ordered it in advance, and it was returned because they thought it was going to be a book about Dracula. It was
a Halloween special.
Right, exactly.
What is so fascinating about studying the behavior of animals?
Well, there are many answers to that question for me personally also. I've always been interested in animal behavior. When I was back in college in San Diego for my bachelor's, I had to decide what I'm going to study. I had the good fortune of having good grades in all of the subjects, so I took one of these psychology tests to find out where I should end up, and there were two professions. The one was biology, the other was psychology, and the third was becoming a preacher. preacher for a church.
Are you a Sagittarian?
No, I'm a Leo, actually. But I decided for animal behavior because at the time San Diego State had a very good, very famous professor. And my goal, lifetime goal ever since those studies, was to meet Conrad Lorenz and Heini Hediger here in Zurich. And fortunately, many, many years later, I did get to meet both of them. In fact, Conrad Lorenz wrote the foreword to one of my books on cat behavior later on. But animal behavior is, I study animal behavior because I can learn more about human behavior by studying animal behavior.
Is that a true statement?
It really is true. You can't transcribe everything from animals directly to humans. But in recent years, my research has been concentrating on dogs and cats, especially cats. I'm known as a cat researcher.
And a cat lover, too.
And a cat lover, right. And over the years, in order to understand cat behavior, you also have to understand how cats and humans interact, because humans influence cat behavior and vice versa. And so more and more my research has gone into the field of human companion animal relationships, and internationally I work in that area. I'm the president of the international umbrella organization in that field. We have world congresses every 3 years with over 1,000 researchers, including medical doctors, psychologists, psychotherapists, social workers, all sorts of ergotherapists, and this sort of thing, occupational therapists, because we've now discovered that animals mean a tremendous amount, much, much more than we ever suspected to people. And this is probably inborn, also inherited in our genes, that we have a particular affinity toward nature, including animals and plants. I mean, we are obviously humans. Homo sapiens is the highest evolved species on Earth, but we are animals. We're the highest primate, and the primates are animals. But I have to say two things. One of my own studies showed that humans are able to interpret animal behavior quite well, especially dog behavior, also correctly. They do it anthropomorphically, that is, they project their own feelings into the animals, but using that, or doing that, they're actually quite capable of predicting correctly the following behavior of the animal. And that's exactly what we were selected to do for over the last 400,000 years. We followed animals, the early humans, while the dogs or the wolves were hunting, and they looked at the animals and had to predict their behavior, and from that they learned. That's the one example. The other example is perhaps best in connection with our work in animal-assisted therapy for people, explained that way. I've had so many experiences. I teach in that area now, also in Japan, where I'm a professor, that I've seen people that have been comatose, or they're in comas, or awake coma, it's called, and I've seen what happens when their dog is brought by the rest of the family into the hospital situation, and all of a sudden
they respond.
You can see it first. You can see it on the EKG, the beeps all of a sudden, and secondly, they open their eyes and so forth. I've seen really some remarkable miracles happen, and this bond between companion animals and humans is really, we're just starting to get to it now.
Okay, we all know the old saying, a dog is man's best friend.
Yeah.
But is it this bonding, this is my old friend, and you respond to it, or is there something really mystical magic about the radiation, the personality, the presence of the dog in this case? Do we know much about that?
Yes, we do have evidence. First, we do have evidence that just the presence of a dog or a cat works in a quieting manner for people. It reduces stress, their blood pressure drops, and of course, only with people, though, that have had good relationships in the past with animals, because, I mean, if you've had a bad experience, had been threatened by a dog, your blood pressure is going to go up.
Once bitten, twice shy.
Right, exactly. But for the vast majority of people, the effects of seeing and interacting with a dog or cat are very positive. And we have been able to show that we have reduced health costs, health care costs.
Yeah, the insurance companies are getting interested in this, aren't they?
Unfortunately, they don't like to hear that when I say that, because they're fighting also with high costs and so forth, and they have to somehow get their money to cover the medical costs. But I say one way of doing that is indeed to give some sort of a rebate or a discount to pet owners, because we can show that they actually do give less money out or expend less money for health care. Also costs at the same income level and everything. They're healthier if a dog or a cat is in the household. Less expenditure on health. What we do need, though, is to make sure that pet owners, especially dog owners, are responsible pet owners, that they don't turn their dogs out onto the streets, and that they keep their dogs under control, that they realize that not all people like dogs. I fully accept and respect that. And there are situations where a dog has to be put on the leash, and there are situations, though, or there should be in every village and city, areas where a dog can roam free, also at least for an hour or so, be allowed off the leash, because that is the true nature of the dog. But, you know, one problem we've had here in Switzerland, as well as Germany and elsewhere, we had an occasional very tragic case of a particular breed of dog attacking either an elderly person or a young child.
Just happened with Rottweilers in Germany.
Exactly. But I know from other studies that since you mentioned Rottweiler, that the Rottweiler is indeed has a high level of aggression. We can prove that. However, its reactivity is very low. That means it takes an awful lot before a Rottweiler would actually attack another person.
But when that level is reached, they snap.
When the level is reached, then it's dangerous also because of the size and the jaw musculature of the animal. But this indeed shows that the problem cases that we have are just cases where the dog has gotten into the wrong hands. The dog itself has a beautiful character.
But, of course, there's the other one on the other extreme, the other polarity, and that's, for example, the Labrador.
Yeah.
They're legendary for their disposition.
Exactly.
They take an awful lot. They they don't react to noise. I mean, they seem to be a wonderful dog as a companion, and certainly with children.
Right. The Labrador belongs to the group of dogs in the one study that I'm thinking about that are often used in therapy work. They're certainly well known as guide dogs for the blind, hearing dogs, and so forth. The Labrador is a beautiful animal. But, you know, it's interesting. For 10 years, I had a practice at the animal hospital here at the university for behaviorally disturbed animals. And the Labrador was one of the ones that I had fairly often because they're so attractive and they're really such a cute dog. People don't raise them properly.
Basement breeding?
Exactly. And the Labrador also requires a master. It's extremely important that they be taught obedience just like every other dog. And in fact, I don't even have to go to purebred animals. Some of the most difficult cases that I handled in those 10 years were little lap dogs that tyrannized their little old ladies that owned them and so forth. Every dog needs a master. That doesn't mean that you have to be a bully with the dog. I can control a dog just with the eye contact.
People sometimes think that's being brutal or dominant, but the fact is the dog was bred that way. It needs a strong hand.
Exactly. The dog,
not in a violent, physically
not,
violent
not
way.
Not violent, but it needs to know where it belongs. The wolf pack, which is the wolf was the progenitor of the dog, the wolf pack has one dominant pair, a male and a female, and all of the rest of the animals in the wolf pack are subordinate animals. And it's natural in the dog's behavior that they continually try to become the boss. Also, they have to test the alpha pair continuously, also when they get older and so forth.
Fight for the top dog.
Right, to fight for the top dog. And once they're reinforced that they're not yet the top dog, that's fine, they accept it.
To go back for just a moment, though, to this whole field, which is very exciting, the animal-assisted therapy. We used to hear about them called therapy animals. We've talked a lot about dogs. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if other animals, for example, cats, can achieve the same thing.
Right. Our own research, I am known as a cat researcher and cat-human relationship. We have made some very fascinating discoveries over the last few years, especially Gerald Rieger, my former master's student, who's now in the United States doing his doctorate. I hope he'll come back and work with me afterwards. We discovered that cats are very significant partners in reducing feelings of depression in normal people, healthy people. We all have a moment of depression now and then, reducing feelings of depression, reducing levels of anxiety, fear, and also in increasing extrovertedness in the people, in introverted people. What we'd now like to do is go to, together with psychiatrists at the University Clinic in time here in Zurich, working with clinically depressed people, inpatients, also not ambulatory necessarily. I mean, they already have cats in the psychiatric station, which says everything, but we'd like to really test the controlled intervention with a cat, with clinically depressed patients, because we really think it will help those people.
It sounds like we're in the field of psychosomatic medicine, which is gaining more and more significance and importance today.
Very much. Not only psychosomatic, also holistic approach to medicine, because we're gaining more and more evidence. Our conferences are endorsed by the World Health Organization. I work together also with the World Health Organization.
They know a little bit about medicine.
Exactly. They know a little bit about medicine, and they're actually quite surprised at the effects that we've been able to publish about animals just being in the room, as well as animals specifically trained to help people.
I can understand how someone who's been raised with a dog or the pet dog is brought into a hospital. Of course, they will respond in a positive way. This is easier to understand. Right. But what about people who have never had any contact with animals, were not raised with animals, they're lying in a hospital bed, someone walks in with a dog, and suddenly the patient responds. Okay. Does this happen?
Yes, it does happen. I'm the last person in the world to force animal-assisted therapy on anyone. And the patient definitely has to be informed. The doctors and everyone else has to be willing and ready to allow this, but only where a patient is willing to have or try this contact should it be conducted, and only when other therapy methods and medicinal methods have not shown the proper success or are not working fast enough. We've got a lot of evidence that shows then that an animal can indeed be the last resort and actually work. What we do have, though, is the situation. We have studies from Stephen Kellert in the United States showing that patients that are in a hospital bed, if they have a window to look out of, and that window looks to greenery, to green trees or fields outside, comparing those patients with patients that look out the window toward a cement wall of another building, that they recuperate and leave the hospital much, much more quickly. So this goes back to the concept of biophilia. That's one of the reasons why we have a natural affinity toward plants and animals.
I think of C.G. Jung, the Zurich psychologist, the famous one, and one of the things he talked about, dogs, they symbolize earthiness, they symbolize instinct, right, and intuition. Right. Maybe therein lies the connection.
It is definitely a major factor in the relationship with the dog, especially in the therapeutic, in our therapeutic work. My two course leaders that do the course with me for animal-assisted therapy are psychiatrists and psychotherapist. Both of them were trained at the C.G. Jung Institute, and we do know that these sorts of effects happen.
Let's look at the University of Zurich. Right. You're an animal behaviorist. Right. You're lecturing here at the Institute in Zurich. Right. How does this university stand in this particular field internationally?
It's very interesting. The university itself is not well known for this particular field. I'm a private faculty member of the veterinary faculty and teach animal behavior to ongoing students of veterinary medicine. And in this, I'm here at employed 50% by the Zoology Institute and teach animal behavior along with my boss, Professor Koenig, here in Zurich. What is interesting, though, is that internationally everyone associates, animal-assisted therapy, you have to talk with Turner at the University of Zurich. And no matter what the show or the television, I was with Gunther Jauch in Germany on Stern Television, that's a very famous show in Germany, about dolphin therapy, and everywhere he called to get an expert to comment on this, they said, well, you have to get in touch with Turner at the University of Zurich. That's not my specialty. Animal-assisted therapy is one specialty, but not dolphin therapy. In fact, I'm actually not in favor of dolphin therapy for animal protection reasons.
Well, here it is. You came to the University of Zurich in 1973. You came to Switzerland in 1973 to do your PhD work. and you stayed on, you decided to stay, and now you've become one of the leading international authorities on this subject, and you have put the University of Zurich on the map in this specific field.
I think this is one of the reasons why the university tolerates me. I'm not a professor here. I am, however, a permanent guest professor at a university near Tokyo in Japan. In fact, I have a private institute, private scientific institute, IET, in Hirzel, Switzerland, which offers these courses, and I'm very happy, and it's a very good symbiosis between the university and my own private institute. Both of us profit from the association, and I love to advise university students, master's students. I have doctoral students in veterinary medicine, also some students at foreign universities, not just in Japan, and I really appreciate the contact with the university, and it's nice for the University of Zurich to be able to show, hey, we're not always doing all of the bad things that you people think about animals when we're doing surgery and this sort of thing. We have some people that are really interested in animal protection, animal welfare, and Turner is one of them.
Are animals, some of them anyway, far more intelligent than we've given them credit for in the past?
Certainly animals are more sensitive, and certainly animals are more capable of showing emotions than a lot of, especially in my field, ethologists, animal behaviorists, would have in the past allowed for. I mean, we're now, even the conservative ethologists are starting to realize, hey, we're probably not that much different from animals. Animals do show fear. They do show excitement and enjoyment of things. It's just the question of how do we measure that. We can't ask the animals, and here we have the ethologists. We observe the animals' behavior and interpret their behavior, and we've done this. It was actually a Swiss National Science Foundation project with Sana Balik and myself, where we were actually able to show that the people who looked at scenes of dog behavior and cat behavior were actually quite good at predicting the future behavior based on their own emotional feelings, and the predictions were correct.
This goes back to what you said before. There's a lot more animal in us than we often were willing to admit.
Exactly. Of course, as I said before, we're the most advanced animal. Sometimes I wonder about that when you see the wars and the battles that are going on around the world. But still, we are the most advanced species, but there's nothing to say that we'll be always the most advanced species on this planet.
Just a final point, it is a very personal question. Dennis, I mean, we could go on literally for hours, and anyone listening to you can hear the enthusiasm the way you talk, and you make the field very exciting. But you came here in 1973, that's well over 30 years ago as we're speaking. Any regrets?
No. None whatsoever. I've become Swiss in the meantime. In 92, I became Swiss. I had the honor when I was 50 years old of being invited in the village, the small village Hirzel, where we live, which, by the way, is the birthplace of Johanna Spyri from the Heidi stories, of being invited to speak at the 1st of August, the Swiss National Day, to our village. And it went over very, very well because I was able to view Switzerland. I had spent half of my life at that point in Switzerland, and half of it in the United States and other countries, but as an American. And I had become Swiss in the meantime and was able to comment on the situation. That was at the time of the discussions about the Holocaust and working that out with the American Jewish situation. And I happened to be an advisor, or was an advisor at the time, to the Israeli Environment Ministry. So I have contacts. I have a student in Jerusalem also. So as a non-Jew, and so I was able to sort of take a neutral standpoint. And I have to say, I've never regretted it. I feel more Swiss now than American. I have lived more than half of my life here.
You still have the American passport.
Right. I still have, and I'm proud of that, of the American passport. But I do have the Swiss passport, too. And there are certain countries that it's actually an advantage to travel with the Swiss passport nowadays.
And the list is growing, isn't it?
The list is unfortunately growing. And I hope that will change sometime again, because I know... my parents, I still have all of my relatives, all of my American relatives in the States, and I enjoy going to the States often. I really thoroughly enjoy vacations in the States. Of course, I often go for scientific congresses to the United States, but I always come back very, very readily to Switzerland. It's small, but a lovely country.
And it's not a cultural shock for Americans. I mean, it's not a vastly different society.
It's not that vast, but I wouldn't want you to ask my wife about how different Americans and Swiss are.
It's all relative.
Right, it's all relative.
No, there are vive la différence, as they say.
Right, right, right. But after the first 2 years, I started realizing that a lot of the aspects of Swiss culture, especially environmental issues where, I mean, Switzerland was collecting old batteries for proper disposal 20 years before the United States ever even heard of that. Also, and they had to. They're a small country with very limited resources, and this sort of attitude fit very well with the way I thought at the time. So I feel very much at home here.
It reminds me of something Peter Ustinov said many years ago when he compared Switzerland to the United States. He said, when I go to the United States, I have the feeling of entering a giant warehouse. And when I come back to Switzerland, it's like entering a well-ordered room.
Right. That's very, very appropriate. I feel very similarly when I visit the States. But, you know, I really feel bad in a way for many of my American colleagues or the citizens of America, because I think there's a real information deficit within the United States. I listen to the news, and I won't mention any particular station, but we all know the major ones. And I come back to Europe and listen to the news here, and I wonder, my God, we're on two different worlds. And I really feel that's a shame. I don't blame the American citizens for some of the things that the government does occasionally, because I don't think the American citizens are even informed about what's going on, and that's not their fault. It's just, it's a huge country, it's different conditions, and that way you just have to accept it. America has a lot of very positive things also, but you know, I grew up when I studied in social studies in high school. I remember we learned all about democracy, but even in the United States, in Pennsylvania, I had my senior year in Pennsylvania, we learned in social studies that there's only one true democracy in the world, and that's Switzerland. And I've come to realize that that is very true.
Where the citizens can write, make, or break laws, and they have the final say on everything.
Exactly. The citizens have the final say on everything. That brings problems in our discussions with the EU. I mean, I used to be at least very much in favor of Switzerland joining the EU, the European community, European Union. Still, I'd like to see Switzerland keep its heritage, keep its traditions, but become a little bit better integrated within Europe. And as a partner of Canada and the United States in North America, I think we've had a rough time the last few years, especially since the Iraq crisis and the Iraq war. But I think we're still allies, and there's still a lot of similarities between the two. And I think it's important that also the Americans realize that the Europeans just have a very long history behind them and are not so ready to give up their own ideas just because we Americans are from a big, powerful country.
Well, as was said, of course, during the controversy about the Europeans, certainly the French not going along, the Germans and so on, actually, both the French and the Germans did make the point that they've been at the business a lot longer than the U.S.
Exactly, and I think that their position will, in the long run, be proven correct. I really do question the legitimacy of the war. I mean, we have international laws that are definitely not being respected by the United States. I mean, my son studies international relations and international laws at the university, another university in Switzerland, and it's just unbelievable the list of laws that the United States broke when they did this. You just don't go it alone in today's world. You have to have international support. It's very difficult, I'm sure, for most Americans to accept the way the French and the Germans did react to the Iraqi situation.
And not only them. I mean, practically the continent at large.
The continent was against going in illegally into Iraq with brute force. Fortunately, it was successful, although they haven't found weapons of mass destruction, which was the original reason. But, you know, you can't go around the world playing the world's policeman and cleaning up all dictatorships. This world has one hell of a lot of dictatorships. And if you really want to go in for that reason, you'd have to go into a hell of a lot of other countries. And I'm sure the American citizenry does not want to do that.
Dr. Dennis Turner, Swiss-American, American-Swiss, since 1973, with the University of Zurich, the animal behaviorist, the specialist in using animals in therapy called animal-assisted therapy, a philosopher, as we can hear, a social commentator, and a politician, as well as world traveler and educator. Dennis, as always, it was a great pleasure. Thank you very much for making the time. And I'm sure if you'll have us, we'll be back to carry this discussion on.
I'll be happy to do that later, Bob. Thank you, too.
Thanks very much, Dennis. For Switzerland in Sound, this is Bob Zanotti.
You were just listening to Switzerland in Sound with Bob Zanotti. For more information, go to www.switzerlandinsound.com.